and present session, stand and deliver effective presentations. We're going to be joined by Taylor Jones today from CulturePoint, where he is a principal consultant there and has experience as a facilitator and trainer and researcher. He has worked in a consultative capacity with DoD clients. He is also a doctoral candidate in linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania. He has presented papers to the Linguistic Society of America, the American Dialect Society, the New Ways of Analyzing Variation Conference, and the Penn Linguistics Conference. And his research has been published in leading linguistics journals, and he has given talks at Stanford University, New York University, and multiple universities. It's a nice long list, and now here on the Cleanup Information Network. So I want everyone to join me here in welcoming Taylor to today's presentation. And I'll go ahead and call up his materials and let him begin with his presentation whenever he is ready.
All right, thank you. And you'll be glad to hear that I can actually see everything in real time now.
Excellent.
It's not the case before. So good morning, good afternoon to everyone out there. I very quickly want to say that I will do my best right now to get you out of here on time or ahead of time, and that's something that I'll talk about a little bit later in the presentation as well. But thank you for having me, and I'm just making sure that I can move my slides. There we go. So today the course objectives for you are threefold. We want to understand how people evaluate presentations, to review best practices for presentations, and to develop a game plan for presentations. So everything in the next just under 2 hours is going to be geared towards working our way through these three components. Again, that's understanding how presentations are evaluated, and then what can we do, really, based on that knowledge that we have. So the agenda for the next couple of hours is, first, obviously, an introduction. Then I'm going to give you a brief overview of the research. I don't want to get too bogged down in all the different kinds of research about presentations, but I'm going to give you a high-level overview of the general findings that are going to be hopefully useful to you before diving into a set of an overview of presentation skills. Finally, I want to talk about putting it all together, and then we'll wrap up and put a nice bow on everything at the end of the session. By the way, I will be stopping periodically to allow for questions. So as you have questions, please feel free to write them in the Q&A box, and I will pause periodically, and Gene will read them out, and we'll address questions as they come up. I'm used to a lot of facilitation with people in the room, and sometimes it's five people, sometimes it's 200, 300 people, but I do enjoy sort of feeding off of audience feedback. So as you have questions, please don't hesitate to send them in, and we'll try and make this as interactive as possible as well. And Gene, if you see anything that you think needs to be immediately addressed, please don't hesitate to jump in.
Will do.
All right, so to introduce this, I want to first introduce who I am so you understand why I'm talking to you in the first place. I'm a facilitator. I have a decade of experience teaching difficult topics around diversity and inclusion. And CulturePoint does a lot of work around leadership, around performance, with a focus on diversity and inclusion. The reason I mention this is because diversity and inclusion are sometimes very hot-button, kind of touchy topics that get people, that elicit strong feelings in people. And so it's something that I have about a decade of experience in, where it's not just talking to people, but it's talking to people about difficult topics. And that's something that I think will hopefully be expertise that will be helpful to you, specifically around your discussion of Superfund sites. I'm also a quantitative social scientist, and I have experience teaching a variety of classes, a ton of conference talks, invited lectures, as well as academic talks for the general public. So again, I'm trying to tie this directly to what it is that you'll be doing, which is talking to the general public. And finally, while it may not seem relevant, I assure you it is. I'm a performer with background playing music professionally, and that ties in directly to managing a room, managing the expectations and the reactions of the people in the room in real time. And what I'll say is I've been, in the last month doing tons and tons and tons of travel for a variety of different talks. So just to give you an idea of the kinds of things that I've been doing, I in the last month gave a talk to a graduate seminar in linguistics at NYU. I turned around and immediately gave a talk on leadership and performance to 45 naval lieutenants and commanders, and then immediately gave a talk to 195 naval civilians before going on and giving a presentation about my research to the judges of the First Judicial District of Pennsylvania. So it's a wide range of presentations, and the skills that I'm going to discuss as we move through this presentation are skills that will help you with that. And I will add, the last one is a couple of radio interviews, which I'm hoping will be helpful for your experience on this particular webinar. So to tie that all together, my career consists of communicating scientific ideas to the general public through presentations, relying on platform skills that we're going to discuss as we continue. So are there any questions before I continue?
Believe it or not, a number of people, Taylor, have commented on your voice, and they want to know if you have, is that an actual skill that you practice to get it to sound, because you sound so polished, like just the tone and the nature of your voice. So is this just how you talk every day?
Yes and no. So I appreciate those questions. I will say that having a microphone or a telephone is something that's helpful, and what I will do is discuss later on in the presentation a number of tips and tricks for effectively talking and for managing voice in a way that will help with presentations, because one of the things that is difficult for presenters is that we get excited or we get nervous. And when people get excited and nervous, we tend to change how we speak, and it becomes a little bit difficult for the listeners. And then, if we notice that in the room, we can start to spiral as we're thinking, oh my God, they're not reacting well to me. So there are some skills that we will discuss pretty shortly. So I stick around for that. Are there any other questions?
Not at this time.
All right. So the first thing I want to do is give an overview of the research on presentation skills. And really the question is, why bother with this? I would argue that there is a wealth of research that indicates that platform skills affect perceived credibility. For all of you, you're public-facing, your work is important, and it's important that it's communicated effectively. So that's all fine and good, but the key here is that platform skills are skills. They're not inherent, they're not inborn, they're not native and unchangeable. So you can learn, practice, and improve. So to dive into the research, first thing, we can tell when people believe what they're saying and when they're confident in it. So there's a lot of research. This is just a very quick overview. But with regards to verbal and nonverbal communication, people can tell when there's a mismatch between the verbal and nonverbal cues. So Tenney et al., for instance, find that people are very sensitive to nonverbal cues of confidence. So as you're moving, as you're gesturing, if you are not confident in what you're saying, even if the words themselves are confident, people notice. The second point here that I have is about the sounds of confidence and doubt, and that's that there are a variety of ways that people can kind of tune into whether we're confident in what we're saying. So there's a lot of linguistic research on this. It's not worth really diving into. The key takeaway here is that when we're not confident in what we're saying, people notice. And the last is the professionals. This is a really interesting finding. Professionals lower vocal frequency when giving expert advice. And this was a study where they actually did they played a neat little trick on some researchers where they asked them about their research, but they also asked them directions to the bathroom and directions to another location sort of in the middle of the experiment. And there's a marked change in pitch of the voice when we're confident in the directions we're giving or when we're talking about our research that we're very, very knowledgeable about. To continue on, the clues about confidence are measurable. So that would be pitch, that's intonation, that's speed. Those all influence perceptions of speaker confidence. And so one of the things that I think about as I'm speaking is speed in particular. I have a habit of talking very, very fast. And as I'm giving a presentation, I'm constantly thinking to myself, slow down, slow down, slow down. A mentor of mine gave me some advice a while back on presentations, and her advice was to think of Maya Angelou. So if anybody's heard Maya Angelou reading her own poetry, the advice that I was given is to think about Maya Angelou and try to sound more like her. Now, that's not to say imitate her voice and imitate her accent and any of that, but it's just the sort of slow way in which she delivers the words clearly and confidently and sort of savoring what it is that she's saying. But all of these things affect perception. So pitch, intonation, these are things that we change, especially when we're not confident. So a lot of times a pitch will rise as we're unsure of what we're saying, and we start to have what linguists refer to as high-rising terminal, which is you start to raise the ends of what you're saying, so it sort of sounds like you're asking the audience right instead of maybe, you know, saying something confidently, and so on and so on. We're also more likely to believe and cooperate with people who send signals of confidence. And the interesting thing about this is it's even when we later think that it wasn't about presentation skills. So, you know, later on, people will evaluate a presenter as having been a better presenter or a worse presenter, and they'll say, oh, it was definitely that they made a compelling argument. But when you do matched-guised tests, what we find is that oftentimes people are making these evaluations where really what was different is the way that the information was communicated, not the content that was actually communicated. So there's a lot there as far as the research. But the important thing here for all of you is that not only can we measure all of this, we can improve it with training. And there's a lot of research on that, but I have just one citation here. So Siebold and Rude, for instance, find that communication training improves presentation skills. So the big takeaway here is that presentation skills matter, that presentation skills and confidence affect speaker believability, and affect audience confidence in what it is that you're communicating to them. And second, the better your presentation skills, the easier your presentations will go. So this is something that I think is a huge takeaway. A lot of us have performance anxiety. We can get stage fright. But the more that you shift everything to skill rather than to chance or to how you feel in the moment, the better your presentations go, because you know that you have the tools to really effectively stand and deliver. Finally, we can improve communication skills with training and with practice. That's not to say that you all should be taking a lot of time out of your day and not doing your work so you can practice your presentation skills, but given that a certain part of your job is public-facing and is communicating research, then there is an element to it that is important to improve communication skills. And finally, I think this is really important to remember. You all have a very important message, and to be able to communicate that effectively to the public is a very important thing. And so this is something that, while it may not be necessarily why you decided to, you know, work for the EPA, You do have an important message, and it is a part of your job now to communicate that message. And so it's important to give time to this and to think about it and to really develop your presentation skills. So that's all I really have to say about the research. I'm going to pause here for questions as well, and then we'll dig into presentation skills in a minute. So are there any questions?
There aren't any questions on your talk, but one or two people did note a clicking sound that I think it's actually just you holding the phone. I wasn't sure if it's physically possible to hold it in a different way or perhaps if the cord is wiggling in front of you, but it doesn't seem
do
like
that.
It's... There you go.
Absolutely.
Excellent. And that's all. Other than that, they are entrenched in what you're saying. They wanted to hear it without the clicking.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And if, again, if there are any other audio issues, if you have a hard time hearing me, if there's anything like that, please just interrupt me if you see that and let me know. Just because this is a slightly different format than I'm used to, and so I'm very, very happy to have any feedback to make it better. All right. So with that said, I'm going to jump in to an overview of presentation skills. So you can divide presentation competencies into a number of different areas. Here I have it divided into four. You can divide it into more. You can divide it into fewer. But I think this is a good way of looking at what will be important for you all. So the four competencies that I have here are content management, visual aids, platform skills, and participant management. And what I'm going to do is go through each of these one by one and just run them down. So content management is hugely important. Effective speakers will connect the subject matter with the objectives. So you'll notice one of the things that I did at the beginning of this presentation is I had a slide and I said, these are the objectives of the talk for today. This entire slideshow is built specifically, so if you go through and look at it, you'll see I say, these are the objectives, and then you can see exactly where in the presentation I meet those objectives. That's hugely, hugely important. And even when you're, you know, giving a research talk or when it's not necessarily the kind of facilitation work that I do with organizations where they're going to say, you know, did you meet the objectives for the contract? It's incredibly important and incredibly helpful for people if they know what the point is, really. What are you going to do? How are you going to get there? And then you can actually go through and give the material and people understand, you know, where this is going and what they're paying attention to and what's happening. So the subject matter really needs to be connected with the objectives, and the objectives should be made clear at the beginning of your presentation. What I will say is it's also important to analyze participants' needs, their current level of expertise, and their expectations. So depending on what the talk is, people, you know, participants will have different expectations for, you know, what they hope to get from the talk, what they expect the talk to be like. And depending on their level of expertise, you may have to adjust how you talk and how you organize the information to really meet somebody at their level. And I think for a lot of you where you're giving public-facing talks, you're giving them to the general public, this is something that really requires a lot of thought before putting together the presentation. So what is the audience going to really be able to understand out of what you're saying? I will also say identify and organize key points that support the objectives and that meet the participants' needs. So like I said, you have the objectives right at the beginning, and then you want to build your presentation around the key points that meet those objectives. And crucially, you want to identify potential problem areas and have strategies to deal with those problem areas. So, you know, there are a number of ways that people could perhaps misunderstand or not quite get, you know, what it is that you're trying to communicate. And if you have an idea of the ways that people can go wrong in advance, then you're prepared for most of what you can run into. What I will say is, you know, often there will be that one question out of the blue that you just have no idea. you couldn't have prepared for it. It's just almost inevitable. But for all the other questions, you should be able to have a clear idea of what kinds of questions people might ask and where they might get hung up. I'll also say that there's lots of variety in style. So to the extent that you can, you have some liberties to play with how you present information. And different people have different preferences. So, you know, some people use full-blown guides with notes and footnotes and, you know, all sorts of stuff. Some people use handwritten notes for themselves. Some people prepare by making mind maps or flashcards. One of the things that I tend to do is treat my slides as flashcards, which is to say I have the front of the slide, which you see, and then I have what I intend to say. And The part that I intend to say is something that the front of the slide triggers for me. So I see that front of the slide and I know, okay, I want to say X, Y, and Z. But I'm not necessarily just reading the slide. So you'll notice I have read parts of the slides and I have said, you know, this is a bullet point, this is a bullet point. But those are designed to elicit something from me that I can expand on and then be a takeaway for you as a mnemonic as well. And finally, what I'll say is if you're using PowerPoint or something similar, you can use the note pages for yourself. And I highly, highly, highly recommend having the note pages for yourself so that you actually can make sure that you're hitting all of the points that you want to hit. Let's see. So for content management, the first thing that you want to do is say, what is the key point of your talk? What is the takeaway? Then you want to sort of step back from there and say, what do people need to know to understand that point? And lastly, you want to really figure out where can they go astray. So for instance, I gave a talk on morphosyntax of Zulu at the Linguistic Society of America. I'm not going to bore you with the details of morphosyntax of Zulu. You can absolutely ask me about it later or send me an email or something if you're dying to know. But what I will say is that the actual point of my talk was a fairly simple statement, and I needed 20 minutes to get there. And so the idea here is I started with the statement. I had a slide that was just, this is the statement about the syntax of the morphosyntax of Zulu, and then said we're going to spend the next 20 minutes getting back to this statement. And that is a perfectly reasonable way of setting up a talk that's going to keep people's interest, where you can work through and say, you know, bear with me, we're going to unpack each element of this. The important point here, though, is again, you want to make sure that you think of all the different ways that you can, that people can go astray. And then also, given the kinds of talks that you're giving, you'll want to be aware of problem areas. So that would be hot issues with a particular group. That would be areas that call for policy decisions that you're not able to make. You want to have an idea of how do I respond to this. And then issues that could create drama. And that's either drama in the room or for the kind of facilitation that I do with organizations, you want to be aware of, you know, internal political issues that may create drama in the room. For these presentations to the public, you want to be aware of, you know, what kinds of political issues are going to create drama just naturally and be prepared to address them or talk around them. So what I'll say is moving into content management, basic organization here would be to introduce the topic, to provide a motivation, to describe the necessary context, to then explain the research question or point you want to make, and then to lay out the data and analysis strategy. And bonus points, I'll say proofread your slides more times than you already have, no matter how many that is, and you'll catch things like the spacing in my second to last bullet point here. So looking at the slides, looking at this presentation as an example, I have an overview of the agenda and what the objectives are, and then introduce the topic. I provided a motivation for you. I said the research says that platform skills are important and that your ability to effectively communicate is going to affect believability, credibility, and what people actually walk away from your presentation with. And then describe the necessary context. Explain the research question or the point you want to make. In my case, the point is really here are the tools for giving effective presentations. And then you lay out the data analysis strategy as necessary. So this is a basic template. You can adapt it to whatever your needs are. But the general idea, this is similar to writing a research paper or to writing a report where the idea is you say, this is the topic. You then motivate the topic so people understand why they should care in the first place. And then you got to give them the information to actually be able to understand what it is you're saying and to follow along. Now, what I will say is you have a variety of approaches that you can use. So as you're documenting findings, for instance, you can go point by point, but you don't necessarily have to, and oftentimes people prefer that you don't. So one thing you can do is just lay out the necessary pieces to make your argument and leave the rest for offline, back channel, question and answer, whatever else you need. So you want to make sure that you really have enough information that people understand what they need to understand to follow along, but you don't have to get bogged down in the details of every single aspect of the research. And I think for a lot of us, especially for researchers, it's very hard to cut information that really, if we think about it, isn't necessarily the most relevant, but you know, we see it as it's related to the whole bigger picture. So you want to really try and take a step back, get a 30,000 foot view, and say, what's the minimum I need for people to understand where I'm going? And then you'll provide comments to explain findings or implications of the argument. So if you have graphs, if you have visuals, you want to be able to explain them to people in as few words as possible, as clearly as possible, and in plain language. And then finally, you'll wrap up. So you want to be able to put a bow on everything at the end of the session and say, this is what I was going to do, this is what I did, any questions? So I'm moving now from content management to visual aids. Are there any questions before I continue on?
So there have been a number of questions that came in. I think you've hit on some of these themes, but let me just ask this one about audiences. How do you handle an audience that has mixed experience? They're asking if you should be talking to the lowest knowledge level or the lowest experience, or should you be trying to address those individuals that do have a ton of experience with your topic?
I think so. That's an excellent question, first of all, and I want to thank whoever asked that because it's a fantastic question. It really, unfortunately, it depends, which I know is not the most satisfying answer. But what I will say is that if you are smart about it, what you can do is bring some of the less experienced people along. And the way that you do that is in part by, as best as you can, if it's possible, defining your terms as you go. So it would be very easy for me right now to, you know, to run with the Zulu example. It would be very easy for me to just tell you my findings. But I would be surprised if anybody on the webinar understands, you know, half the words that I'm saying because they're technical jargon. One of the ways around that is to explain that jargon at first mention. And this is a little bit further along in my presentation as well. I'll reiterate this point. But as you have something that's technical or that people won't necessarily understand, one of the things that I like to do is try and put it right down the middle. So have just a little bit of the technical jargon, but make sure that you explain it as you use it. And then the flip side of that is if you can explain something in plain language where it's understandable to the average layman, but then throw in an aside for the people who really understand at a much higher level what you're saying. And by that I mean, you know, for instance, I could say, you know, I found that Zulu noun phrases behave in a similar way to noun phrases in other languages like Hebrew, where it's unexpected that they would behave the same. That should be pretty understandable to everybody. And then I can throw in, and for those of you who have training in linguistics, I'm specifically making a claim about construct state. So I have the jargon there. People know that I know what I'm talking about. You know, the two people in the room who are familiar with research on construct state will say, oh, this guy knows what he's talking about. But everybody else feels like they're actually following along as well. So does that answer the question? Now you got to follow up with the person. Normally when asking questions or answering questions, I will follow up with the person and say, did that answer your question? It's a little bit harder in this format, so hopefully I'll get a yes at some point, and if not, I can circle back around.
Okay.
Was there anything else?
Yeah, there's a number of them that have come in, and these are kind of hammering in on the visual aid, so I might hold them back, but somebody did ask about practicing. Do you suggest people practice their talks? Should they work with like a mock audience? Or any suggestions on practicing?
I have a slide on that a little bit later as well, but what I will say is that absolutely, it depends on the person. So you may find that you get stressed out at the idea of practicing your talk. Other people are stressed out at giving a presentation if they haven't practiced it 20 times. So it really depends. I know a lot of academics, you know, that you have this standard 30-minute conference talk, 25 minutes to talk, and then 5 minutes for questions. And I know a lot of people who give, you know, 10 practice talks before they're even willing to go talk. I know other people who know exactly what they're going to say, how long they need to say it, and they just walk in and off the cuff very confidently just tell you all about their research. And it's very well done. So it really depends on your comfort level and your level of experience. But I would say that especially if you're not comfortable giving talks, that it is very helpful to time yourself and to maybe even write out a script, give a practice talk at home, give two at home. If you have friends who are willing to listen or coworkers who are willing to listen and give you feedback, then do that as well. And I'll reiterate that in a few minutes. So is there anything specifically about the content organization before we move on?
Not that I'm seeing in the queue now, but remember, okay, if we don't address it now, we can always come back to it later on. So I encourage to have those questions and comments keep coming in the Q&A.
All right. So I'm moving on to visual aids now, and I have a lot to say about visual aids. So effective speakers prepare visual aids that are legible or readable, clearly related to the content being presented, and that's a huge, huge one, organized, and consistently formatted. And what I'll say is that academics have a habit of making slideshows that are basically bullet point versions of their papers. The worst academics have a habit of making slideshows that are just papers. It's just paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs of material, but they've cut it into slides instead of pages. Don't do this. This is a really, really easy way to completely lose an audience. So yeah, you have a lot of information there, and yes, it may feel like you're communicating effectively to somebody else, but unless you're just giving it to them to read as a paper with, you know, weird shapes of paper, it's not an effective way to give a talk. And there's a lot of reasons for this. One is that, you know, people, if you're trying to actually give a talk, people are going to sit there and try and read this entire slide and, you know, listen to what you're saying, and either they're not going to listen to what you're saying or they're not going to read the slide, but either way, you lose people very, very quickly from, you know, trying to write a full paper, a bullet point version of a paper in slides. So the slide is a visual aid to jog your memory and to give key points for the audience to focus on. And I have as a note to myself here to talk about Pentagon slides, but I believe we've included slides from the Pentagon. So I'm going to ask about those in just a minute, ask your opinions and thoughts on those. The key here, though, is you want it to be readable, related to the content that's presented, and something that people can look at, can pretty quickly process, and that is going to reinforce what it is that you're saying to the audience. Now, there's a variety of things that are important about managing your visual aids. One would be testing equipment, having contingency plans. So Gene can attest that we had, first of all, a test of equipment last week, and then a contingency plan if this didn't work. So I had a handful of problems with Adobe that are, you know, arcane problems related to Flash on certain operating systems, and we had all kinds of backup plans. We had backups on backups on backups in order to deal with the possibility that I couldn't see or manipulate the slides for this talk. And that's exactly the kind of planning that you want to have for a presentation. So, for instance, you know, academics routinely at conferences will have their own adapters, their own cables. You want to make sure if you're using your own computer that you have your slides loaded up, that you have whatever power source that you need, that you have whatever adapters you need, and you want to be able to really make sure that you have contingency plans for your visual aids. Now, the other thing is, you know, if you absolutely have to, can you give your presentation without visual aids? How confident are you that you can do that? Now, for visual aids, as you're actually giving the talk, what I'll say is it's important to position your body to avoid blocking the participant's view. And this is easier said than done. depending on the format of the room. So you want to make sure that you're not doing anything weird as far as your body language and your behavior, but that people can actually see the slides. You're not, you know, if you have to stand in front of it, you stand in front of it. You know, don't contort yourself weirdly to avoid that. But the general idea is that you have these visual aids specifically so that people can see them. So if you have, you know, a poster, don't stand in front of the poster as you're talking. If you have slides, you want to make sure that you stand to the side and position yourself so that people can see. As you're in a larger room, this becomes trickier because depending on how many versions of the slideshow you have, on how many screens you have, you may be blocking some participants' views as you walk around or not. If you're lucky, you have one big screen and you can stand to the side of it. And then lastly, what I'll say here is speak to the participants rather than to the visual aid. I would normally hear say something about making eye contact and trying to just scan the room and make eye contact with everyone. Obviously, I'm not making eye contact with any of you right now, although, you know, my apologies for that. But it really does depend on the format. When you are talking in a room with people, you know, make sure that you actually are speaking to the participants rather than just looking at the visual aid. So the question that I have for you all is, what makes a slide bad? And before you answer it, feel free to answer in the Q&A. I want to show you a couple of slides and ask you, what makes these bad? And Jean can read out your responses or share your responses. We're going to take it a priori that this is a bad slide.
I don't think that's a hard leap, in my opinion. So just quickly, I'll remind the audience that there's a small box that's popped up in the bottom left corner of the window where you can actually free text a reply indicating what you think makes us a bad slide. And as I'm scrolling through some of the response, it seems to be
a consistent
too many words.
I'm seeing too many words, too much text, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, people are commenting on that background.
There it is.
The background is interfering. Even if they could read all of those words, that the coloring and the imagery are just working against each other.
Exactly. And the solution here, by the way, is not we should have made the font black or we should have made the font orange or whatever the color you want to have is. It's really, one, everybody's correct, it's way too much text. This actually meets the EPA standards for a number of bullet points, but it's just way too much stuff in each of those bullet points. You notice these are full sentences. They are giving you way more information than you need. And then, as a handful of people have pointed out, it's over a large image. Yes, the image is related to the subject matter, but it's really very, very difficult to read. And so what I'll say is, if you're going to have an image, and I do highly recommend using images where possible, what you should do is organize the slide so that you have an image on one side and relevant text on the other side, or an image on the top, relevant text on the bottom. Just superimposing the text in the image is very, very difficult for people to read. Let me see if there's anything else here. I see cramped, too small. Yeah, the fonts are too small. Irrelevant information, noisy.
We have had a few other things pop in on the other window. Someone brought up that it's not 508 compliant, which is a whole other universe in terms of looking at the materials.
What is 508 compliant?
So that's particularly in the federal world. 508 compliance refers to the requirement to make materials available to all individuals regardless of their abilities. So for individuals who are blind, they might use a screen reader, and the software is set up to read material in a certain way, and it would not be able to digest
exactly
the text on top of the image.
Exactly. I know a different shorthand for that, but that is a very good point for screen readers, or for you know, a variety of other issues that people may have with the slide. It is very, very difficult to make it accessible for people.
And I'll just chime in here. Somebody else had an interesting point that you made a good slide of what a bad slide is.
I'm very happy that somebody noticed that. So what I will say is, and this is one of the ways that I make slides, is you know, I have a header that says a bad slide. and then my image, and that's it. So if I have a slideshow and I have the liberty of placing images with it, one of the things that I'll recommend that you do if you have images, if you have graphs, is give them their own slide. That helps people actually be able to read them, make sure they're labeled in a way that's understandable, but then you can take a moment and explain what's on the slide. And what I'll say is, you know, the amount of time that you need for any given slide, it's going to depend on what your presentation is. I had a note in here to say to talk, you know, 3 minutes on each slide, but I'm realizing I give presentations that are 2 hours, 3 hours, 6 hours long, and so I may have a slide up for 3 minutes or for 10 minutes. That may not necessarily be ideal for your presentation. If you're giving a 20-minute talk, then 3 minutes a slide is insane. So you want to make sure that you really put the information that you need to get through on, but the idea here is really communicate it to people in a way that they can digest it, that they can see it, understand it, digest it, and then move on to the next one. So this particular slide, I would probably break into 5 or 6 slides on its own and work through them one at a time. I'm going to move on to the next bad slide and ask you what's going on here. And I will say this is from the king of bad slides. This is from the people who make the absolute infamous worst slides, which is the Pentagon. And you can Google this. They are known for terrible slides. I see way too much info in all caps come up here. So a lot of you are pointing out it's way too much information. It's small print. I would say it's also impossible to really, in the context of a presentation, follow where these arrows are going or how they connect or how they're related to anything. So whoever built this slide deck, they may in fact have all the information that you need for their entire presentation in this one image, but it's not communicated in a way that actually is intelligible to anyone. And even if we could blow it up and, you know, have a bigger font and you read it as a poster or something, it's still just too much stuff. Everything's connected to everything else. You know, none of it really makes sense. The color coding doesn't really make any sense. It's just far too much stuff. So are there any other comments on this?
I think you hit the nail on the head. It's just so much that they can't comprehend all of the information that's on there. It's not clear why they have colors, why they have arrows, what exactly the overall trend is supposed to be, other than everything seems to connect to everything.
And I will say to build on this, that, you know, if you want to see some truly terrible slides, Google Pentagon slides. And if you want to think about how do I make an excellent slideshow, Google Pentagon slides and do the opposite of what you see. Because it is absolutely spectacular. So what I will say is as you're building slides, I'm going to go back a couple of slides here. What you want to do is really keep it legible and readable, clearly related to the content, organized, and consistently formatted. And consistently formatted may, in fact, be solved for you. So I know that for this presentation, the EPA has standards of how they want slides done. It's a maximum number of bullet points, maximum number of things on the page. And those are there for a reason. So this is a very good format, and I highly recommend actually following those, which is, you know, no more than 6 bullets. And if you have to, you can, you know, if you have 12 bullet points, you can break it into 2 slides. Or you can break it into 3 slides. It's probably even better. Same thing with the visuals. You can put them on their own slide, or you can have, you know, some sort of comment next to it, but definitely try to avoid superimposing. The idea here is you want the minimum number of words and the minimum number of images to convey the maximum amount of information in conjunction with your presentation. So the point is not that you have a whole novel written in slide format. And what I'll say is that academics in particular are notoriously bad for this because they want you to understand everything, so they write everything down and they just put it in a slide, and then they'll say, you know, can you give me your slides? I wasn't at your talk. When I'm asked, can I have your slides? I wasn't at your talk, I will absolutely say, yes, you can have my slides, but you may not be likely to be able to follow the argument because the point of the slides is secondary and it's to support the presentation. Any questions on that before I move on from visual aids?
So we have a few questions about physical visual aids. One participant wanted to know if you would comment on the use of animation to bring in text to sort of stage the visuals.
I would recommend against it, but it really does, again, depend on your audience. If you know for certain that the audience will love animations, then do it. The only animation that I use is really masking and revealing text. So it's just, you know, adding a new bullet point to the same slide. I don't do that with a crossfade. I don't do that with a zoom in. I don't do that with the words, you know, spiraling into the center of the text. If you know for a fact that you're presenting to an audience and you know who the audience is and you know that the audience will like that and find it fun, then feel free. But you do run the risk of people negatively judging the presentation based on, you know, thinking that you're adding too much cutesy stuff. So I will give you an example. There was a linguist who gave a talk at the Linguistic Society of America annual meeting a few years back, and her research was absolutely fantastic. I was really impressed with her research. I've cited it in papers. It's really good work. Her slideshow was animations and memes and, you know, stick art and cats, and it was not well received. So it was that you have a room full of grad students and professors and academics, and they were going, this person doesn't know what she's talking about, because this is just a frivolous slideshow and they're not taking the professional aspect of this seriously. Now, that's an extreme example, but it's one end of the spectrum. And so what I would say is it's probably smartest to play it safe when you don't know who the audience is and keep it just either plain slides or, you know, revealing the next point, but not, you know, crazy animations. And especially not, you know, stick art and memes and everything else. Any other questions?
We had a few others. I hope you don't mind. They kind of seem to be honing in very much on the visual aids here. A couple of people have asked about alternative strategies in the visual aids. So some people are asking if you should make separate handouts so that you can keep all the information in there and then have a much more streamlined visual. Okay.
I think that's an excellent idea. So if you believe that there's a lot of information that's very relevant that people maybe they don't need to understand it to get the big takeaway from your presentation, but a number of them may want that information, then I would say it's absolutely very helpful to have handout with bullet points for, you know, supplementary information that's relevant to the talk that you're giving. What I will say is that's probably much, much more effective than just having that all in your slides. And the reason for that is you can give your presentation, you can stand and deliver your talk, you can really focus on covering the main bases that you need to cover. And people aren't distracted by, you know, very cluttered slides or you trying to rush through more material than you have time for, or, you know, all of the challenges that come from having just far too much information in a slide. So that is potentially a very good solution. And I'll say, you know, I know there are certain domains where that is just the norm. So for instance, if you go to, I keep giving examples from linguistics conferences, but they're relevant. So I apologize. I'll branch out to something else in a minute. But if you go to syntax, specifically syntax talks, the norm is they hand out handouts with charts and with bullet points and with further elaboration of their arguments. And then if they have slides, they'll be much, you know, they'll be pared down from the level of detail that's in the handout. So you can take the handout, you can read more, you can really dig into it, but it doesn't take away from the presentation, because it's not all of the information all at once in too short a time and too few slides.
Okay. Would you recommend sort of going the extreme opposite end and do talks with no visual aids?
I think that's a possibility. I think it depends on the presenter's confidence, and it depends on the audience. I generally like to have visual aids, and I find that, you know, in 10 years of doing facilitation work and doing presentations, that visual aids are something that people respond well to. Often people expect visual aids, and what I will say is that just having something is usually helpful as far as just managing the room. People react better to it. So, you know, now if you want to have a fairly minimal set of visual aids, I think that's fine. But in general, I would recommend having something that people can, you know, refer back to, and that'll help focus their attention as you're talking. I mean, if you're super charismatic about your research and super charismatic about Superfund sites, and you can really get people, you know, going, and you don't have to have, you know, specific images or graphs or anything to convey the information that you can't just convey verbally, then by all means, go out there and wow people. But in general, I know I feel more comfortable having something that can refocus people's attention, and that they can, it can anchor their attention as you're giving a talk.
Yeah, we have a couple of people just sort of chiming in about the need to appease the visual learners, that not everybody learns your audio, so that something visually may be necessary to get everybody in the room.
Talking around that, because I'm also a visual learner, so I definitely, you know, if I'm going to remember your talk, more than likely I'm going to remember something that I saw on the slides, and that'll jog my memory about all the other stuff that you said.
Okay, so I see a bunch of comments on this one topic, so I'm just going to bring this last one up, and then we can move on. You referenced EPA guidance or guidelines on presentations. So there's two groups of questions here. A bunch of people who work for EPA have never heard of this, and they wanted to know if you could possibly share where you found this resource, because they were interested in looking at it. And then in the other camp, the people who had heard of it, you really didn't like it, and actually felt particularly some of the visual requirements and templates that they're being forced to use don't help, that it kind of eats up a lot of space, and they have all these unnecessary logos and swooshes. And so, yeah. So I don't know if you can comment, A, on where it comes from or how you found it, and then what would you do if what you're being asked to do doesn't line up with how you're intending to present?
Yes. Okay. Those are both excellent questions. The first one, I will say, did I get them from you, or did I get them from? As I was putting together this presentation, my contacts sent me a template and said, this is what we use. And the template itself is one of those meta templates where you have slides that both are formatted how they should be formatted and also explain the formatting. If that makes sense. So it's, you know, six bullet points explaining to use six bullet points and what font to use and all that. I completely, fully understand and empathize with the sentiment that this kind of formatting is sometimes a little frustrating. And sometimes it can be a little tedious. So, you know, at the very beginning, I have a title slide, and it's got specific graphics that are provided to me, we'll say. I fully understand not liking the template or the layout, but what I will say is, if you are giving a talk, and the talk is because you're a representative of your organization, and your organization has a format that they do things in, then it's just go with it. you can maybe affect change if you have discussion about it offline or you know, outside of giving the presentation in a different context. But when it's time to just make a presentation and to give that presentation, I would say do what I did with these slides and to put it maybe too bluntly, just, you know, sometimes you just have to suck it up and deal with a template that maybe you don't like that much. So I fully understand that, but I think it's not worth the time or the energy, really, as you're putting these together, because you have other jobs to do. It's not worth the time or the energy to spend too much mental bandwidth on worrying about the exact formatting. Think of it as a sonnet, right? Where you have a specific format, and that's just the way it is. It's this many rhymes and this pattern. In this case, you have this much space, and you're going to have a band at the bottom that has, you know, EPA. You're going to have your title slide that looks the way that it looks, whether you want it to be something else. And the reason for that is, of course, going to be that you then have a standardized product that looks very official for the general public as you're presenting this. But I know that I definitely do sympathize. But my advice, my professional advice, is just go with it. And what I will say is that the EPA slide template is so much better than some of the other templates that I have had to adapt to in the past. And, you know, I have this bad slide still up. I will say that just as you're conforming to these templates, be thankful that you don't have to do slides for the DoD. So I hope that answers the question. I know it may not be the most satisfactory answer, but it's the best answer I have for you. It's not worth spending the bandwidth on thinking about how to change it when it's time to put together a presentation. If you have plenty of extra time, you can feel free to talk to whoever you need to talk to and say, can we think about changing our official slide template, which I'm sure happens. The template itself has changed since we last gave a stand and deliver presentation for NARPM sites, which was, I think, 7 years ago. So there are changes, but honestly, it's not worth expending the energy when they have a specific format that's designed to be official, whether we like it or not. All right, so with no other questions, I'm going to move on to discussing other technology and then get into platform skills before wrapping everything up and tying a nice bow on it. So for other technology, what I will say is arrive early and find your point of contact for your technology if there is a point of contact. And arrive early can mean different things. Find your point of contact can mean different things. So for instance, for this webinar, what that meant for me was doing a dry run on the platform a week ago. Generally, that's not going to be the case. So as you're going places and giving talks, what you want to do is if you're talking at, for instance, if I'm talking at 8 a.m., I will show up at 7 at the latest. I'll find my point of contact. Sometimes I'm the first person there, but I'll find my point of contact and sort out the technology right away, because more often than not, there's something unexpected or somebody forgot something or, you know, there's some glitch, and you can sort it out if you have enough time. But what you don't want to do is be, you know, supposed to speak at 1 o'clock and find yourself not talking at 1:05 or 1:10 or 1:15 or whatever the time ends up being because of a technological issue that could have been solved. The second is test the microphone setup, if it's present beforehand, and if there is a microphone setup, use it. Don't assume that everybody can hear you. And there's a variety of reasons for that. One is if they can't hear you, they probably won't say anything, even if you tell them to. So I've seen countless presentations where people say, you know, if I'm not going to use the mic, but I'm sure everybody can hear me. And there's people in the back grumbling, no, we can't hear you. And they say, well, if you can't hear me, just tell me to speak louder. A couple of problems there. One is that people will start to speak louder, and then they'll kind of quiet down again. We'll just fall back into our normal way of doing things. The other is that people won't necessarily tell you if they need you to speak louder. They might just tune out. And then another reason for this is you may have people with auditory disabilities or with other reasons that they are relying on the microphone. And you don't want to make an assumption about people's abilities or disabilities, and you don't want to make an assumption about, you know, what people's needs are. So if you have something that can make your presentation more accessible, just use it. Even if, you know, you don't really like to use a microphone, even if you have a preference of, you know, types of microphone or whatever, if they have a lavalier, if they have a handheld, just use the microphone. Now, I'm getting into platform skills, and this is where I have a lot to dig into. So feel free to interject questions, but I'm probably, I think what I'll do is hold until I've gotten at least halfway through this, because I'm probably more than likely going to answer your questions, you know, as we work our way through. So what I have here for the basics on platform skills is, you'll notice, 6 bullet points. This is actually just chance. It was 6 things that I wanted to say here. And so one is prior preparation. Then we'll talk about posture and movement. Then we'll talk about breathing, speed and pacing, asking questions, and answering questions. And there are specific skills that you can practice for each of these. So for prior preparation, we talked about this a little bit. Is there a preferred format? Use that format. That helps you with the preparation. So that's another reason to just go with it, is it's one less thing to think about. And then you want to figure out what's your time frame for providing secondary material. So if you have slides, if you have a poster, whatever your visuals are, that's something that in advance you want to know, do I, for instance, need to bring my computer and have my own slides on it? Do I need to send slides to a point of contact? If I need to send slides to a point of contact, when's the deadline to have the slides to them? Right? These are all things that you want to be thinking about in advance, so you don't show up and expect that somebody else has the slides and find that, well, you know, they don't have a computer to project them on, or vice versa. And what I'll say is, you know, with military clients in particular, this has been huge for me. It's been really ingrained, because you can't necessarily bring your laptop depending on where you're giving a talk. And so that's something that, because my, you know, speaking career has had a lot of things on base, it's something that it's become second nature. Just always follow up with what is your time frame for providing secondary materials, and you want to be prepared a week or two out so that if there's anything that changes, you're ready for it. You'll also want to decide if you want or need a script. So this is stuff that we talked about a little bit earlier with some of the previous questions. If you want a script, if you need a script, there's no problem with that. I would say write it out and then deliver it, time yourself, and see what you need to cut. And more than likely, you need to cut something rather than add. Although if you find that you have 20 minutes to talk and you write a script and you only talk for 10 minutes, then you want to start thinking about either did I say that way too fast, or what do I need to add in order to really communicate this effectively, or what can I add? Practice. So you'll decide if you need to time yourself. What I will say is that nobody likes going over time. I have never, ever given a talk where I've gone over and people have said, thank you so much for keeping us for an extra 10 minutes. So for any talk, you know, make sure that you have an eye on the time, and make sure that if you're going to talk, you either get people out on time or early. Now, I'll say, you know, I'm here and I'm supposed to speak to you for 2 hours. I've already hit the 45-minute mark, but I wouldn't talk for 45 minutes and then say, okay, that's all I got, you know, good luck, because I'm also contracted to talk to you for a certain amount of time and to have a certain amount of content. So you're going to want to hit a sweet spot. But if you end, you know, if you have a 20-minute talk and you do it in 18, nobody's going to be upset at you. If you have a two-hour thing, you do it an hour and 45, nobody's going to be upset at you. People get very, very angry if you go over. And especially, I talk at the Naval Postgraduate School once a month, and I talk from 3 to 5 p.m. I'm the last talk in the day. And if you were the last talk of the day, you had absolutely better not keep people late from going home. This is just hugely, hugely important, because you can really do everything right and completely lose an audience if you go over time. So That's all I'll say about that. What I'll say as well for prior preparation is that you should brainstorm possible questions. So I mentioned where can people go astray. Don't focus only on the smart questions. You want to think about how might people not understand what you're saying, and think of as many creative ways that people can misunderstand or not understand as possible. Because even as many as you think of, people will still surprise you with ways to not understand. Now, let's move on to platform skills. So there's a lot to dig into here. I have a couple of slides here. I think I broke this, so it's 7 points that I broke into 2 slides. So effective speakers are going to manage nerves, voice, eye contact, your body, gestures, language, and your transitions and segues. So starting with nerves, what I will say is that everybody gets nervous before giving a talk. It's completely normal. So I expect every one of you to be nervous before giving a talk. Sometimes you don't expect it. Sometimes you get lucky and you're not nervous, but sometimes, you know, you think you're not going to be nervous and you find out that you are. Be prepared for it. And one of the really interesting things that's a recent finding in neuroscience that I will share with you that has been very, very helpful for me is that the way that we actually make emotions is processing in part physical sensation, and that different emotions have similar physical patterns. So there's a fantastic book called How Emotions Are Made, and I strongly recommend if you're interested in that kind of thing to check it out. But the key takeaway from that is that excitement and charisma have a lot of the same physiological patterns as nerves, as nervous energy. And so, you know, elevated heart rate, you know, maybe starting to sweat a little bit, you maybe have a slight, you know, dump of adrenaline, whatever else. These are all things that you can transform into a positive for yourself if you're aware, okay, I'm having a completely normal physiological response before giving a talk, and I can feel this as absolute panic, right, and build it into panic, or I can think about this and feel this as excitement for giving the talk. And if you can reframe it as excitement, you're going to do great. You're going to be fine. With the voice, actually, it's one last thing. So don't try and fight the fear is the takeaway there. So don't worry about whether people notice you're nervous. Everyone's nervous. Everyone expects everyone else to be nervous. And if you start thinking, have they noticed that I'm nervous? Are they judging my nerves? Yada, yada, yada. Then it just adds a layer of nerves to your presentation that then, you know, can make you feel like you're spinning out, even if you're just, you know, standing in front of a room of people. It's not that serious. You'll do fine. But just remember, nerves are natural, and you can refocus that energy. Moving on to voice. Volume, pace, and intonation are important. And I've touched on these a little bit. So one, you want to think about where it's logical and helpful to vary your tone of voice. You want to think about what points do you want to stress. So there's a ton of research in linguistics on how we draw people's attention to specific ideas through stress, through intonation. I'm not going to bore you with all of that. But just think about what are the key points of what I'm saying right now. And also remember, silence can be your friend. So, you know, think about communicating across a noisy channel. Don't talk too fast. You want to make sure you take your time and enunciate. And also, don't be afraid to repeat yourself. In fact, that's very helpful for people. So often when people give presentations, they're wary of repeating what they've said because they don't want to, you know, sound like they're unsure, or there's a variety of reasons that they can be unwilling to repeat themselves. With an audience, though, generally people are hearing this information for the first time and they're learning from it. And so what you want to do, really, is repeat yourself. Make the point a number of different ways. Make sure that you do it clearly. So that's not to say, you know, just say the same thing over and over and over again. But repetition is absolutely your friend. And silence is also your friend. So, you know, give yourself time to think. Give yourself time to breathe. Give yourself time to take a sip of water. I think a lot of times people feel very uncomfortable pausing before an audience, especially if it's to have a sip of water or something else like that. But audiences understand. They completely expect you. If you have a bottle of water, once you raise that water to your mouth, they're expecting a couple of seconds of silence, and it's not sound that you absolutely have to fill. I'll also add that if you're hearing yourself mic'd, that may be disconcerting if you're doing it for the first time. But one of the things to recognize is that we all hear our own voices differently than everybody else does, because we're hearing it resonating in our skull. And so when you hear yourself either on a recording, normally if I were in a group of people right now, I'd ask you how many of you have heard yourself on a recording and said, I don't like the sound of my own voice. I'm just going to assume that there's a handful of you out there. And what I will say is that that's completely natural as well, but recognize that that's just because we're hearing it across a different medium. We're used to hearing ourselves, again, in our own ears, you know, resonating in our own heads. And so when we hear it externally, it sounds uncanny to us. It sounds not like how we hear ourselves. And then people say, well, I don't like hearing my own voice. I would say just let that go. It is what it is, and you don't sound as bad as you think you sound to yourself. And so I was actually recently at an event where we had Navy civilians giving presentations to other Navy civilians about a project that they were working on. And I had somebody at first refuse to use the microphone because he didn't like the sound of his own voice when he heard it through the microphone. The issue is, again, going back to individuals with, in the Navy terminology, they say individuals with targeted disabilities. But specifically, you know, we had people who were hard of hearing in the room, and they then couldn't hear the presentation. So I will say, it's normal, it's natural, but recognize that it's more effective to be able to just give your talk, use the microphone, don't worry about how you sound, and you know, we can all go back to judging ourselves after our presentations, but during, just get it done. Moving on to eye contact, what I'll say is you want to try to make eye contact with the participants. This doesn't mean pick one and just stare at them. That would be a bad idea. And this doesn't mean, you know, you have to make eye contact with each individual in the room, you know, by the time you're done with your talk. But in general, looking at the audience is a good idea. And what I'll say is, I know a lot of you are engineers and are scientists. There is a joke about engineers. It also applies to linguists, so I'll give this joke about linguists. But the joke is, how do you tell the outgoing linguist? And the answer is, they're the one who's staring at your shoes rather than their own when they're talking to you. Now, that's an extreme example. But the idea there is telling. There's a stereotype about, you know, a lot of us academics, and it takes a little bit of effort for some of us to make sure that we actually are giving a presentation in a way that's, you know, that the average person is going to find sociable and understandable. And I will say, take the time, take the energy. It may be uncomfortable, but try to look out at your audience and not at your shoes or not at your notes or not at your slides, and really look at the people that you're communicating this information to. Also, what I will say is, don't be bothered by one or two people who, you know, are listening in a way that you may not feel like is a good way to be listening on one-on-one conversation. So, you know, if I give a talk to a room of 45 people, sometimes I'll look out, and especially if it's that, like, afternoon talk, it's after lunch, you know, it's 3 in the afternoon, it's a warm room or something, there's going to be people whose eyelids maybe droop a little bit. And sometimes those are the people who come up after you and say, you know, I really appreciated your talk, I really enjoyed it, and they say, you know, I really liked X, Y, and Z, and I thought they were dozing at that point. So it don't be alarmed by you know, one or two members of the audience just doing their own thing. People are going to be distracted, especially in large groups. But in general, if you're looking out at the audience, they're going to be looking back at you, and you can feed off that energy. You can tell how well you're doing. You know, unlike just now when I told a joke, you'll know if you tell a joke, you know, whether it lands or not. And I'm going to get back to jokes in just a second. But eye contact, just, you know, be scanning the room and keep an eye on what's going on. with body. That's posture, stance, and movement. What I'll say is you want to stand straight, both feet on the floor. When you move, move with purpose. And generally avoid shifting from side to side, standing on one foot, pacing around. This depends on the space. This depends on the room. So if it's a very large room and you have a handheld mic, for instance, then walking around and talking to participants can be a very effective strategy. But in general, if you're standing behind a lectern, for instance, then, you know, wobbling back and forth side to side is going to be distracting for the audience. So I strongly recommend taking a power stance, and if you need to elaboration on that, you can Google what a power stance is, but take one even before the presentation. That's been demonstrated to help with confidence. And then as you're giving your presentation, you know, you can stand in a confident stance, and that will actually help you. It has been demonstrated will help you be confident. So don't try to hide. Don't hide behind the lectern or, you know, behind people. There was one session that I was at where it got somewhat contentious. I was working with another facilitator, and as the audience was kind of going back and forth with themselves, he slowly started backing away. I don't think he was aware that he was doing it, but he just slowly started backing away from the audience and kind of shrinking down. And I had to say to him, like, stand in front of them, like, move forward. And it's, you know, it can be natural, but just you're in charge there. You're in charge of the room. Don't be afraid of the audience. And you know, if you stand with power, you stand with that mindset, it's going to help. Moving on to gestures, I will say they should be meaningful. So if you're worried about what to do with your hands, a good thing to remember is you don't actually have to do anything with them. So oftentimes people can be distracted from a presentation because they'll see the presenter fidgeting with their hands or picking at their nails, or the absolute worst is just trying to do something natural with their hands, but clearly thinking really hard about what natural thing to do with their hands and not really ever settling on something. So like the hand goes in the pocket, the hand comes out, the hand goes on the hip, the hand goes behind the back, the hand scratches the head, the hand picks up the bottle of water, sits down the bottle of water without drinking. Just, you know, remember, if you're holding a mic in one hand or a pointer in one hand, laser pointer, something to pull slides, that's very helpful because it gives you something to gesture with. But, you know, if you're thinking about the other hand, you don't actually have to do anything with it. If you don't naturally gesture that much when you speak, that's fine. If you do, feel free to gesture, although you want to try and keep it pared down a little bit to something where it's meaningful related to what you're talking about. This next point about language gets back to a question that was asked earlier. So depending on your audience, what I would say is avoid jargon that they're unlikely to understand. That said, for technical language, the best practice is to use the term and then immediately define it, then repeat. So as an example, I had a friend who was learning Russian. She had this whole secret plan. She helped pay for her brother to study in Russia, and she decided to learn Russian in secret. So when she went to visit him, she could surprise him. And during the course of this, you know, she asked me to help tutor her. And if I said, oh, that's a dative case marker, she would just shut down. She would say, I don't know what that is, yada, yada. If I say, you know, that's a dative case marker, which means it's the thing that does X, Y, and Z. So, again, you know, dative case marker does X, Y, and Z, and then continue. That is a much more effective way of getting people along. So before people can say, I don't know what that is, and get angry at you and zone out or shut down or, you know, whatever, the idea is that you introduce technical jargon and then immediately define it, and then repeat it, and then continue. I will say also, hopefully this doesn't have to be said, but swearing is in general a bad idea. So you may know your audience better than that, but in general, I would strongly suggest staying away from swearing. And for some of us, that requires conscious thought and practice. For others, it may come naturally. But really, just talk to people. It's that simple. No flowery language, just use simple sentences. Think about how you would explain what you need to explain to, you know, family and friends who don't have the same background and experience as you. I mentioned that I would talk about humor, or that I'd cycle back around to humor, and I will say a couple things about it. One is that it can be a benefit, but it can also be a detriment. So if you're going to make a joke, you should be very sure about how it will land, and you want to be very, very clear about that. We at Culture Point tend to use a lot of humor and a lot of humorous stories in our facilitation, but it is very well calibrated, and there are some times that, you know, we find, okay, that didn't work, and we scrap it, but it's something that we really are paying a lot of attention to. I will also say that there's a 2019 study in the Harvard Business Review. It's Evans et al., and they find that women in particular may be negatively evaluated for humor, especially self-deprecating humor, that men are, you know, either not evaluated at all for or positively evaluated for. So if you are, you know, if you are female presenting and you are on this webinar and you're going to be giving a public-facing talk in the future, I would say think hard about how any humor that you hope to use will be interpreted. And I hate that I have to say that, but just for you know, having success with presentations with the world as it currently is, it's something to be aware of. And building on that, I will say also that you know, not only are women judged differently on presentations, but also this is going to intersect with other aspects of your identity that are visible to people. So, you know, black women are judged differently than white women. If you present as straight, that's going to be different than not. And so, you know, be aware of how your identity or your perceived identity affects how people are going to react to your presentation. And I wish I could say that you didn't have to worry about that, but as is, for the purpose of being effective here, it's something to keep in mind. And I'll say, you know, doing a lot of this work around diversity and inclusion in particular, there's a quote that always stuck with me, which is, you can be effective or you can be right. And I think a lot of times we want to be right. This doesn't just apply to diversity and inclusion here, but a lot of times we want to be right. And I think the key here is we need to focus on what is effective. You can be right all day, but if you're not effective, it doesn't matter. So that's all I have to say about language for now until we have questions, and I'm sure there will be some. And lastly, I want to talk about transitions and segues. So it is very important to move smoothly from topic to topic. And one of the ways that you do that is by having a well-outlined presentation and then referring back to that outline at each point. So you'll notice what I did is I said at the beginning of the session, I said, this is our objectives, this is the agenda, this is the outline of my talk. I'm going to be pausing for questions here, here, and here. And generally what I try and do is say, I'm going to talk about X. Then I talk about X. Then I say, I talked about X. And then I move on to the next thing, usually with I'll pause here for questions or something else along those lines. So I strongly recommend, you know, making it clear to the audience where you are in the presentation. So here, you know, we're wrapping up on platform skills, and what I would do is, I'm actually about to do, is say that this is what I had to say on platform skills, and that there's, you know, 7 points that we talked about. And are there any questions about this before I move on? Now, quickly, because that's a sort of meta-analysis of that, I'm going to hold the questions for just a second and say that I had a professor at Wharton, when I all the linguists at UPenn do statistics at Wharton, and this professor had a brilliant system where every class, he had a two-hour class twice a week, and every class, the first half hour was literally what we did the last class, just condensed. And then, are there any questions? Then we move on to the new material. And then last half hour was summarizing both. And it was absolutely brilliant. There were people who skipped the first half hour and the last half hour of the class. And I never understood them because it was a way of really understanding what that previous, you know, what the previous class or what the previous hour was really about. And I strongly recommend building a presentation that way. So the idea being that, you know, I'm telling you, we had the agenda. I gave you a motivation for why we're talking about platform skills. And now we've gone through platform skills. What we're going to do next is leave time for questions. But starting here, are there specific questions on platform skills for effective speakers? And now I mean it for the questions.
All right, excellent. So we had, just so that you know, the audience was with you. They appreciated your humor. They were typing in their laughter when you were making
your joke. Okay, good. I didn't see any of that.
So your joke landed. It landed well.
Thank you.
We did have some questions about how you should dress for a presentation.
Yes.
Suggestions?
Well, I think that depends on your audience, and that depends on how you are representing your organization. So there's some organizations where they just tell you how to dress, and that makes it very, very easy. So, like, you know, my Navy clients, they show up, they're told how to dress by the Navy, and it's done. The far flip side of that is I am doing a webinar where you can't see me. So I am in ICF offices, and I'm you know, dressed in business casual, but generally the note that I always like to give is think about what your audience will be wearing, if you know, and you want to be one level up from that professionally. So, for instance, I give a talk at the Naval Postgraduate School. They're usually there in, we'll say, khakis and polos and, like, nice shoes and a belt, so I'll be there in a dress shirt and a tie. If they were in a dress shirt and a tie, I would be wearing a blazer as well. That's, you know, that's not necessarily a hard and fast rule, but it is a way of establishing a level of authority. You stand out just a little bit as just a notch more professional than whatever the audience is. So if you don't have specific guidelines for your talks, you can't go wrong with something that's at least business casual, if not more professional. And you can tone it down. I mean, what I will say is I have shown up for talks where I'm in a dress shirt, tie clip, blazer, everything, whole nine. And I realize that I've overshot the mark. It's, and I will say it's easier for men, but it's for people wearing menswear. But it's, you know, I can take off the blazer if I need to. I can roll up my sleeves and take off the tie and whatever and kind of balance that out. If you're thinking about, you know, women's wear, then you have to put some thought into it in advance because it's a lot harder to do that kind of quick change. Although you still have similar options with business attire. So, you know, having a blazer, take the blazer off. In general, I would say you want to be prepared to be, like I said, just a notch more professional than you expect your audience to be.
Okay. It definitely does, but we're getting a number of questions just on suggestions for women. So one person particularly wanted to know if there are specific things that you, in addition to what you've already discussed, you think women should or should not do. And I'm just going to repeat what somebody else suggested as an example. They said that they had been educated as a mentor, and this is a female presenter, to speak in a lower pitch when they were in a meeting with men and women because it would convey authority to the men in the meeting.
So, I don't want to get too sidetracked, and I want to answer the question as best as possible. What I will tell you is that you're all veering dangerously into my area of expertise, which means I want to talk. So what I will say is that women are in a bind. Women are in a catch-22 here, because if you speak too high, then people say you should speak lower to be taken seriously. And there's a fair amount of research that says that a relatively low vocal pitch based on your voice range generally conveys authority. However, there's also the fact that if you are perceived to be, you know, altering how you speak in order to make an impression, then people may perceive you as being duplicitous or unnatural or whatever else. And there's actually been a lot of discussion among linguists on social media and elsewhere recently about some discussions of public figures who, you know, talk in a low voice. There's the woman who had there's a couple of documentaries about her. She had a blood-related technology company, and she's a sort of con artist, I believe, having not seen the documentaries. But one of the things that people talk about a lot is, like, was that her real voice, or was she dropping into this artificial baritone? And so I'll say it's tricky. People will negatively evaluate how women speak, and a number of the things that they negatively evaluate would be high-rising terminal, which is if you raise your voice at the end of a sentence. Usually it's something that is approximating, like, if you think about how we give lists. If you say, like, I'm going to the store and I'm going to pick up bread and eggs and cheese and milk, right? The first three would be high-rising terminal. That's something that we know from a ton of research, and just from, you know, if you pay attention in the world, you know that young women in particular are very negatively judged for speaking that way. That said, it's something that everybody does, including men, especially younger men, if you break it down by age. Similarly, women are negatively judged for creaky phonation, which is anything where your vocal cords vibrate slowly enough that you can actually hear the individual pulses. That's something that men do all the time. If you watch Star Trek, Mr. Spock does it all the time. But it's something that women are sometimes negatively evaluated for. So I am very, very wary of saying you should do this or you shouldn't do that, because I don't think that women should be evaluated for those things negatively. I recognize, however, that the world is such that you may be, and it gets very tricky as far as professional presentation, both in terms of dress and in terms of speech. What I will say is the main things that you can't go wrong doing is eliminating ums and uhs. Everybody's negatively evaluated for that, and it's harder to do than it sounds, but it can be done. And what I would say is, you hear me just saying and thinking about it. What I would say is also, silence again is your friend. You can leave silence rather than saying or And if you have any sort of verbal tics, your friends can tell you about it. I used to say indeed all the time. I know somebody who for a long time used to ask right after making an assertive statement. So they're an expert on their research. They would state a fact and they'd say right because they want the audience, you know, to indicate that they're going along with what they're saying. That's something that those are relatively easy to get rid of. And if you don't get rid of them, people are generally distracted. As far as attire, as far as changing your voice, I would argue that you should not have to and that you should not do so. But I recognize that if you feel like it's something that you can do and you're at danger of being really severely negatively evaluated based solely on something like creaky phonation or high-rising terminal, that it's something that you may think about addressing. With creaky phonation in particular, I'd say that's something that for some reason really annoys people, even though it's a completely natural linguistic process. In order to address that, it's actually very easy to address if you're talking to a large group, because if you're speaking loudly enough, generally your pitch is going to be such that you don't have creaky phonation. You can't speak loudly enough and creak. So if you're speaking loudly enough for a presentation and for a large audience, then that should take care of itself. But beyond that, I would say think about how the audience is going to potentially react to you. And as much as I'm torn here, because I don't want to give the advice that you should, you know, change how you're speaking or that women are doing anything wrong, because you're not. But what I do want to say is, you know, be aware of how audiences may perceive you. And it is tricky. It is unfair. Is there anything else before I move on to soliciting questions and then closing out the rest of the session with the rest of the questions?
Well, so how about accents? Should you try to hide your accent if you have one?
Oh, Okay. Yeah, accents are also negatively judged. I am an expert on this. I have a paper coming out in Language, which is the premier journal in linguistics, specifically about African-American English. And what I will say is that accents are tricky because there's a number of different ways that we evaluate them. So there are negatives. For instance, people may be aware that there are negative stereotypes that, you know, people with Southern accents aren't intelligent, or people with African-American accents aren't intelligent, or whatever. These are all based around social things rather than anything inherent to the language of the accent. I would not caution people to really work hard to change their accent. What I will say is if for instance you're a non-native speaker of English, then maybe if your accent is confusing to people and you know this about yourself, it may be worth thinking about working on. But beyond that, you know, if you're thinking like, okay, well, I'm from the South, like I would not necessarily worry too much about that. That's something that if the audience is going to have a problem with you because you have a Southern accent or a Canadian accent or a California accent or whatever, then that's on them, and they were going to have a problem anyway, no matter what.
Okay. The questions keep coming in, but I think in the interest of time, we might carry on
and then answer them in a minute. So I want to move on to soliciting and answering questions, and I think that's getting us into the home stretch, so we should be good. But like I said, I'm going to get you out of here on time. So one, you should assume that there will be questions. Maybe there won't be, but you should assume that there are. You should ask, what questions do you have? And you should avoid any questions. Now, any questions people can use as a way of indicating that they're done with their presentation, but generally if you say any questions, there won't be any. The other thing is, after you ask for questions, stop talking and wait for several moments for them to think. This will be very uncomfortable because oftentimes you feel like you're at the front of the room, you're there to talk to them, you know, they're all looking at you, and so you ask any questions and then you have, you know, 100 people in a room staring at you. It can be a little tense, but count to at least 10 before then asking again, were there any questions? Count to 10, and then if there were no other questions, you know, move on and feel free to talk to me afterwards. But you want to give time for people to think about the questions that they have. And what I will say, I saw another colleague of mine recently gave a talk and was a little frazzled and said, are there any questions? If you don't have any questions, then I'm going to talk about this. So did you have any questions? Are you sure there's no questions? All right, then I'm going to move on. Give absolutely no time for anybody to actually ask their question. So as long as you're talking, people are not going to ask their questions. Now, on a platform like this, it's a little different. You can type them in. You know, we get around to them. But in person, you really need to leave that moment of silence, and it's a perfect time to take a drink of water and, you know, you can collect your thoughts. For answering questions, there's a couple of best practices. One is to let the questioner finish. Don't cut them off. Assume you know where they're going. Two is to rephrase the question back at them. So if they say, X, Y, and Z, then you'll say, the question was, if I understand it correctly, X, Y, and Z. And by that you mean, you know, X, Y, and Z. The reason for this is twofold. One is not everybody will have heard the question. So, you know, especially if you have the microphone and the person who's asking a question doesn't, then you want to make sure that everybody actually hears the question. And two, it gives you a chance to make sure that you actually understood the question correctly and are answering the right question. Because sometimes you'll spit your question back at the person who asked it to you and they'll say, no, that's not what I'm asking at all. So it helps you clarify. What you should do then is refer to the central theme of the speech, so bring it back to the actual content, bring it back to the point that you're talking about, and feel free to postpone an answer or throw the question back to the group, depending on what the material is. So, you know, if it's a question that only you can answer, then don't ask what does everybody think the answer is. But if it's a social thing, then you can allow for conversation. And then lastly, I think it's really important, respect the questioner and indicate that you respect the questioner. So you thank them for their question, even if it's a difficult question. Sometimes also you can just let the audience answer for you. So that ties directly into participant management, and this is the home stretch now. So Effective speakers are going to use participants' names where possible. So if you have a room of 200 people, you know, you're not going to learn their names. You'll reinforce desired and appropriate participant behaviors. That's just by, you know, positively doing so. And refer to previous contributions if that's something that's possible. I expect most of you are not doing facilitation, but you're actually doing, you know, a talk and then a Q&A. So you should respond appropriately to questions. You want to manage challenging participant behavior and make the experience enjoyable. I don't really have much else to say about that slide, so I'm moving on. With contentious participants, I think this is the most important part here, try to take their questions in the best, most charitable light. So if somebody says something really nasty, do your best and recognize it is your job in this moment to do your best to take it charitably and well. So I had this talk with the judges of the First Judicial District in Pennsylvania last week or 2 weeks ago, and I had one judge stand up, and it was one of those things where it's more of a statement than a question, and the statement was, you're wrong and your research is bad. And that was something where I took the time, I tried to take it in the best possible light, and I said, thank you for your feedback, which is the second point here, and thank you for bringing this up and allowing me the opportunity to clarify, because you know, it seems that I did not make the research protocols clear. And then in that case, what I did was go through and elaborate step by step what our actual research protocols were. And you know, this is something where it's a contentious topic, and she heard some wrong information about it. So I could see her coming along, and I said, well, we did this, and we did this, and we did this, and we did this for this reason. And she goes, oh, because she thought it was something else. So thank them for their feedback. Even if they're wrong, thank them for bringing up the topic and allowing you the chance to clarify. But then also don't get stuck repeating or clarifying or in a back and forth with somebody in the room. If you get in this loop, just cut it. You're in charge. You say, you know, thank you again. I don't think we're going to be able to solve this right now. I would love to discuss this with you more offline after the talk. And make sure that you actually stick around afterwards and can do that. And then if their comment's not relevant, just thank them for participating and refocus with the option of discussing more after the presentation. So often what you'll get is either somebody who's contentious and wants to have a back and forth with you, and that bores everybody else, and you lose control of the room, or they want to say something you have, I have no idea how this is relevant to the talk. And if that's the case, you know, thank you for that, and then you pivot back to what you were actually talking about. So the last thing I want to do here is talk about the gift of feedback, and then I'm just going to move into questions and answers for the end of this. So feedback is something that we always talk about at CulturePoint. Feedback is a gift. And so as you're prepping these presentations and just also in life in general, feedback is a gift. But it needs to be specific rather than general, focused on behavior and not on the person. So not, you know, you're terrible, but you know, specific behavior. Descriptive rather than evaluative, meaning, you know, not that behavior is terrible, but you did this and it had this result. Concise, well-timed, and that's hugely important, and then checked. So what I mean by all of this is that good feedback is not necessarily good job, way to go. The actual gift of feedback is something that you can learn from to improve. And often that's a little difficult for us. It's difficult to give, and it can be difficult to receive. So if you're giving feedback, you want to time it. You want to make sure that somebody is receptive and can actually receive the feedback that they're getting. And you also want to think about, you know, what can I say that's actually useful and actionable for this person? But as you're prepping for your presentations and as you're giving the presentations, I would strongly, strongly urge you to reframe contentious behavior from participants, if you are confronted with that, and hopefully you're all lucky enough to not be, to reframe that as you know, a gift of feedback in disguise, to thank people for their feedback, and to really try and learn from it in an actionable way. If people just want to be nasty and say nasty things about you, then that has nothing to do with you. So that is leading me right to this wrap-up and questions. And the wrap-up here to think about is related to the objectives at the beginning. It was, what have you learned about presentations, about yourself? And to think as you're going forward, what will you do differently, or what will you do as you're preparing for these presentations in August, I believe it is. And thank you. And now I would love to open it up for questions for the remaining time that we have for questions.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to get through a series of questions that we have, and in fact, I just did what one of the questions was asking about, and that was for speakers who use or when they talk. Do you have any tips in how they can avoid using that?
I just said so
exactly.
the thing about it is it serves a number of different functions, and so the question is, I don't, as a linguist, I don't think that you necessarily should even want to eliminate all of them. That is an unusual answer, and I recognize that it's an unusual answer and that audiences may not share that belief. And so what I will say is that what I have done is I tried to eliminate most of the ahs and ums that are not communicative. So for instance, what I mean by that is when I just answered that question, I started with a long drawn out that communicated to you that I was thinking about the question, but I'm not saying every third word. One of the things that I strongly recommend is just sit down and think about whether or not you're saying practice your talk, or practice whatever you want to practice, and really think about, when do I say And it will be painful at first. But what I'll say is that you can replace those with silence. And nobody knows the difference, because usually what we're doing is we're filling silence, and we're usually filling silence because it's a way of indicating that I'm still on my turn in conversation. But in presentations like this, we're not really in conversation, and it's going to be your turn no matter what. And that's why people get distracted by it in the first place. So you have the opportunity, you have the option of just leaving it in silence. And I strongly recommend either doing that, just try to replace them with silence, or, and you can even think in your head if you have to, or really just pausing. I mean, I guess that's two ways of saying the same thing, but you'll notice I said or, and then I pause for a second and put together my thoughts. I say, and, pause together, put together my thoughts. It's just training yourself to be comfortable with that second of silence. What
okay.
else we got?
All right. So same vein here, but this is the word like. I'm going to read this statement verbatim because I think it's worded a very specific way. If they want to know if you can weigh in about the use of the word like that is sprinkled so much throughout normal conversations these days.
Yeah.
It's used generally as a way maybe to emphasize a point, but another frequent use of the term in regards to they want to know, is it proper, or should we instead be saying regarding or with regard or in regard?
You shouldn't have picked a linguist for this. The reason I say that is because we're very strongly opposed to just reproducing ideas of what's proper and not proper. So what I will say is that when people talk about proper, it has to do with prestige, and it has to do with social prestige rather than anything inherent to the language. So I won't tell you that any of those are wrong. What I will say is that you should think about how they may be socially evaluated. So if you say in regards to, that was the question, correct? In regards to?
Yes.
Okay, if you say in regards to, and you're aware that you normally say that, but you're also aware that people, you know, have a bee in their bonnet about in regards to, and they expect it to be with regards to or regarding, then it's worth, when you're giving this kind of presentation, tailoring your presentation to the audience. And in day-to-day life, I would say absolutely say whatever you want. For these kinds of presentations, if you know that that's an issue that you have, then I would say, you know, try and address it, but also don't beat yourself up too much if you accidentally say it. I am a professional linguist. I am about a month shy of defending my dissertation, and I definitely just said to a room of 195 people, while talking about linguistics, I said irregardless. And then immediately said, did I just say irregardless? So it is a, you know, it's something that happens, and I would say don't beat yourself up over it. But this is all what we generally refer to as audience design. So if you know you're giving a talk, if you know you're trying to be, you know, professional and formal, and you know that you have a habit of saying this one thing, then you can think about trying to address that in professional settings. But okay. I'm not going to say you're wrong. Okay, next. Okay. Let's get you out of here with that.
I think just in the interest of time, I'm going to hone back in on a theme here with comments and questions. Everybody loves your presentation, and I can tell they love Excellent. Your presentation because they are narrowing in with very specific, well, what would you do in this case, or what would you do in
Excellent.
This case? So I have a lot of questions that are in here. But one of the things that keeps coming back is that how do you get all of this work done? It sounds like that there's a ton of preparation that goes into getting ready. So do you have a general formula with how much time you spend preparing for a talk like this?
I don't actually. It's something that I kind of like this stuff, so I don't know that my answer in that case would be all that helpful. What I will say is this: a lot of this stuff is just little social things that you can practice whenever. And the main thing that I want you to walk away from this with is a handful of skills for, like, this is how I'm going to put together my slides, and that should be easy. You didn't know it before. You know it now. You can refer back to this presentation as you're putting together your slides, and it shouldn't take that much time. And then, so that would be organizational skills, you know, how you put together the actual visual layout of a slide. And then the rest is platform skills, and that's just remembering to breathe, remembering that your nerves are natural and that you can sort of translate that to excitement. And what I will say more than anything else is all of this goes back to breathe and slow down. And remember that you are the expert here. So you're communicating important information to the general public, and you are the expert. You know more about this than they do. You're there so that they can learn from you. So just if you can relax, breathe deep, and slow down, all of the rest of it starts to fall into place as far as the actual physical platform skills. I hear silence. Is there anything else here? Are you all there?
No, I was taking my second. I was taking my second.
All right.
No, I think actually in the interest of time, we'll probably go ahead and close out the live Q&A segment right now just to be sure that we do not go over time. Today, and we can get through a few of those final reminders. But I do want to, again, express gratitude for joining us today. I'm getting a lot of messages that were typed in there. Just people really appreciated your detailed response and your perspective and what you're able to share. And there were a lot of other questions that came into the queue. And I'll be sure to pass those your way, Taylor.
Please do pass them my way. I'd love to address them.
Beautiful. I will walk through just a few final reminders here before we go ahead and close things out. And now I'm saying too many times.
No, we're just aware
now.
Of it.
That's right. But the first thing I'd like to do is echo gratitude and thanks to those of you who were joining us online for today's broadcast. We did have about 130 live participants today. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. If you'd like to join us on future webinars like this, feel free to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network website at cluin.org, or you can sign up for our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month and does help advertise sessions like this. For those of you looking for copies of the presentation materials, we do have those posted currently on the seminar resources page, so you can look on the middle right of your screen, scroll through that list of the related URLs, click on the seminar resources one, and then press the Browse To button to open it up. If you are looking for contact information for organizers, you'll also find it available on that middle right under related URLs. And I will ask each of you to take just a brief moment to fill out our feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's delivery. Now, one of the most frequent questions I get is if we offer CEUs or PDHs, and while we don't offer those types of credit hours, we can give you a participation certificate after you fill out the online feedback form. So if you follow the link to the feedback form, you fill that out, do two things. Make sure your feedback form is filled out completely, includes your email address, and then you check the box at the very bottom of the form certifying you were here for the whole event. Once you submit feedback, you will then immediately have access to a certificate that at least verifies your participation in today's event. If you happen to participate in a group, each person can fill out that feedback form even if they didn't register individually. So if you were the one who registered, I encourage you to share the link to the feedback form to the colleagues who joined you so they can get their own certificates. And then, of course, if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still follow the links under related URLs to that feedback form and fill out the form based off the archive playback. So, as noted, today's session was recorded, and you'll automatically get an email as soon as it's available for on-demand playback. But we are going to deliver the session a second time. Remember, at the very beginning of our session today, we noted that this is the first of two live deliveries on this topic because we think it is that important. So if you didn't get enough today and you'd like to join us again, you can certainly schedule for sign up for the second scheduled delivery, and that'll take place on Wednesday, July 10th from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern. So with that, again, I thank everyone for joining us. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.